Welcome to Two-Way Street. If you've been a regular listener to our show, you know that during almost 3 years on the air, we've brought in a wide range of guests from all over the country. But from the start, we've always liked doing shows with Southern storytellers. Today, we revisit our conversations with three of the very best, Kay Powell, Frances Mays, and Roy Blunt Jr. First, Kay Powell. Over her 13 years at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, she established herself as one of the country's preeminent obituary writers. From 1996 to 2009, Kay wrote hundreds of obituaries, some funny, others poetic, still others capturing a quirk or fascinating detail that illuminated the lives of the recently deceased. Here's my conversation with Kay, recorded in August of 2014.
When I was obits editor at the AJC, we always said, we write about how they lived, not how they died. If you go back and read those obits we wrote, and I say we because I had a team of writers through the years, different ones, there might be one sentence about death. There might be another sentence about funeral plans. At the tail of the story are survivors. In between, we sum up the person's life. Now, it's not a biography. It's not a eulogy. It's a news obit article. They are news. What's the first question people ask when somebody dies? And what's the second question? What did he die of? How old was he? So those two elements must be in a news obit article. It doesn't matter who you are. Now, we did have some women who kept their age such a secret, even their children didn't know. One who was a prominent businesswoman here in town even lied on her passport. So you kind of make that part of the story explaining why you're not telling how old they are, because even the children don't know enough to tell you.
Let's back up.
All right.
What was your thought when you were invited to take that position? How did you feel about that job?
I loved the idea because Ron Martin, who was the editor at the time, said he wanted to do two things. He wanted to write about ordinary people, and he wanted to create a sense of community for the readers to feel ownership in the paper. And I was so excited. And Bill, to the day I left, there was never a day I didn't go into work that I wasn't looking forward to it.
So an individual dies. You decide that you need to write the obituary of that person's life. And so you have to begin developing sources, those who knew that person well enough to give you the kind of information that could give you the opportunity to write a rich obituary, an accurate obituary.
Yes, accurate is the key word there. It's all a matter of building trust, and it starts a lot of times with the funeral homes that would give us the family contact information. How you approach that family when you get them on the phone, getting that conversation done, asking them for friends. It's always important to have an outside voice. And so I spent a long, long time giving my little spiel of who we write about and how we choose them and all like this to the funeral directors, to families that called in. Eventually, the readers caught on to what we were doing and loved it. And so a lot of times we would have them call and not necessarily tell us about a family member that they thought we should write about, but somebody in the neighborhood maybe that was unique, that was very little known, or just somebody interesting. So it was a complex system of building up trust.
But that first phone call.
Yes.
The phone is answered at the home where people are grieving, and you say, I'm Kay Powell, I'm with the Atlanta Constitution, and that can be a tough moment to get people to talk, can't it?
I used to teach an entire course on the psychology of words and how important it is. Usually it would be, I'm Kay Powell with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and I am not selling you a subscription. Mr. Smith at the funeral home gave me your number to contact you. I was so sorry to read about Mr. Nygaard's death from the information in the funeral home, and I was captivated by the fact that he spent his life collecting 45 RPM records. I want to talk to you about that, to write an article in the paper. Is this a convenient time? And sometimes they would say, well, I can't talk right now. I'll talk to you next week. And you say, I would love to talk to you next week, except this is a daily story. And I can understand completely if you don't want us to write the story because you don't have time. Oh, no. I'll make time. I have time. But you start out with that sort of building trust, giving them confidence, letting them know straight up what you're calling for and what you're doing. And sometimes it takes a hard left turn. What you call up to start writing about in print winds up something entirely different because of your conversations with the family, with friends, your research and archives. You find a dimension to the person that you didn't know anything about.
This was a job that meant more than just gathering basic facts. This was delving into and creating as complete and accurate a portrait as possible.
One of my writers said, you know what Case is, bring them back to life. And that was our job, was to capture sort of what was the essence of them. And again, you can't tell their entire life story, but you want to capture sort of what defined them, capture some of that personality.
I believe you, at one point in your career, said, be careful about living till you're 90 because your obituary is going to be shorter.
The longer you live, your 90-inch obit becomes a 30-inch obit. Yes.
How did you decide which people would get obits and which wouldn't?
My whole career in journalism was in hard news and breaking news and as a news reporter. And that builds an instinct in you, coupled with a curiosity. And the least little item about somebody could catch my attention. I saw that somebody was a Kmart greeter, and I said, well, we've never written on a Kmart greeter. Well, it turns out the man had been CEO of an international furniture company. In fact, they made the furniture that was used in the house in the television show Dallas. He retired. He got bored. He missed being around people. So he took a job as a Kmart greeter. How can you know that? I saw that somebody priced groceries in a grocery store. I said, well, everybody has to buy groceries. We've never done this. Let's write on him. Well, it turns out he collected prize-winning show-quality skunks. And he even had a motorcycle with his best prize-winning skunk airbrushed onto it. I figured if I was curious about him, the reader would be too.
You wrote an obituary that really tells a pretty powerful story about a collection of people you would not expect to see together.
I loved it when we could reveal in our obits information that were little known or unknown, particularly about Georgia and Atlanta history. And when Jim Sanders, the wine merchant, died, I interviewed Doc Lawrence, who's in the wine community here, for his obit. And Jim Sanders at his wine shop had in the back what he called the soup kitchen. Every day he'd cook up a meal, pair it with the European wine, and those in the know knew they could go to the back room and eat and drink and talk. Well, one day in that room were former Governor Marvin Griffin, who was a segregationist, Ralph McGill, liberal editor and pro-civil rights advocate of the Atlanta Constitution, and the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who was in the shop buying champagne for his and Coretta's anniversary. The three of them wound up in Jim Sanders' soup kitchen, eating and drinking and telling stories and laughing and carrying on all day long. Jim had to run them out of the store to lock up for the night. And when he looked out the plate glass window on the sidewalk, those three men were still telling stories and laughing and slapping each other on the back.
And you learned all this as you researched the obituary of Jim Sanders.
Yes, when I interviewed Doc Lawrence, he told me this, and he said, Kay, I've never told this story to anybody.
You didn't write obituaries about people only. You wrote an obituary for the planet Pluto.
Yes, I did. It ran on the front page with a huge graphic, but I wrote the obit for Pluto the planet in our AJC obit style. And this was the lead. Pluto, the least of the major celestial bodies, never asked to be a planet. Once elevated, it became an influential figure in astronomy and astrology, in classical music, and in cartoons. And then in our obits, we always had a cause of death and funeral plans. So for Pluto, I said, no memorial service is planned because it has been several years since astronomers considered Pluto a real planet. And then at the end, we always listed survivors. So for Pluto, I said, survivors include 8 planets, Earth, Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Neptune, Saturn, Uranus, and Venus.
I'd like to read one back to you.
Okay.
And this is in keeping with the philosophy that Ron Martin suggested, which was that you write about ordinary people. And this one was very touching to me. Mike Huddleston, 44, Noonan. Every 8-hour shift, he worked at Delta Airlines. Mike Huddleston was responsible for getting 5,000 pieces of luggage to the correct spot at Hartsfield International Airport. His record was so outstanding that Mr. Huddleston was featured in a Discovery Channel special, The Secret Life of Luggage.
I saw that he was a baggage handler. I called the family. I got the usual things. I got information from them about his supervisor at Delta. And that's when, at the last minute, I got the details about his being featured in that Discovery Channel. On the job, he lost 4 fingers. 2 were reattached, and 2 never were able to be reattached. But he kept a positive attitude working.
Bruce Williams of Coweta County. You wrote an obituary of Mr. Williams, and you learned something from Griffin Bell that you used in the obituary that was pretty interesting. What had Bruce Williams done?
Bruce Williams made a sausage that Griffin Bell called rooster pepper sausage, and it was famous and popular and well known. And when Jimmy Carter was in the White House as president, and Griffin Bell was his attorney general, Griffin Bell felt like they needed rooster pepper sausage. And Griffin Bell, the attorney general of the United States of America, would smuggle rooster pepper sausage into the White House, past the Secret Service, past all the guards, past all the checkpoints. And he had half of Capitol Hill hooked on rooster pepper sausage.
I want to share with you, again, something you wrote. You talk about how details enrich an obituary. Mm-hmm. And one sentence that you cite is, she was so little, her shorts met her socks.
That gave me an image immediately. I can still see that little girl in my mind.
But then you talk about clothing in a way that really gives us a very strong image of the kind of person you were writing about. Dale Sheriff, a construction worker. His Levi's always had a crease down the center of the leg, and he polished his work boots. We know a little about him, don't we?
You get a picture of him, I hope. I hope.
You get to know people, ironically enough, after they're gone in that job. There's got to be some slightly dissonant feeling about that, I would think.
It's a personality profile, but there did. In fact, I'd go to my editor and I said, Laura, I've got to have more space. I have gone and fallen in love with this man. And she said, Kate, you fall in love with all of them. You've got to start falling in love with them when they're alive.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue my conversation with Kay Powell, one of my favorite shows in the almost 3 years that Two-Way Street has been on the air. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, we're beginning a series of shows that will run through June, featuring some of our favorite guests in the almost 3 years we've been on the air. One of my personal favorites was the conversation I had in August 2014 with the celebrated obituary writer Kay Powell. You became very well known nationally, certainly in this, and we should point this out, there's quite an association, national association, of obituary writers. Yes. You all follow each other's writings yes. over the years.
It's the Society of Professional Obituary Writers. And we are a small but thoroughly enjoyable group that it is international. We have members from, I think, Israel, Spain, Canada, Australia, the U.S., the Bahamas, from all over. We try to get together at least once a year. It might have to be every other year.
You became quite well known in that group for some of the people you chose to write about. So, for instance, you chose to write an obituary of a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Grand Dragon.
Grand Dragon.
Calvin Craig. That was a challenge in talking to his family. I called them, and they were resistant. And I explained to them, because he was such a public figure, an article would be written one way or the other. And I thought it was important to have the family talk about him and get their voice in the article and get their perspective in the article. And I talked to the wife, and I talked to the son, and I talked to the wife, and I talked to the son, and I talked myself blue in the face, explaining. The son finally told me, he said, I just want it to be fair. And I said, I couldn't write it any other way. I understand completely if it was my daddy, I'd want a fair article too. The wife even called Ron Martin, the editor, trying to stop the story. And he came down to the newsroom and said, I've gotten a call from, I said, Ron, he was a public figure. There's no way in denying we need to cover it. There needs to be a story. He backed me 100%. And when I got off the phone with the family talking to the son the last time, I got a standing ovation from the newsroom for the way I'd handled it. But it was a fair story. I talked about his work in the Ku Klux Klan. I talked about Zernona Clayton getting him to leave the Klan. They were served together in one.
Zernona Clayton being one of the really great figures in civil rights.
An early, highly active civil rights activist and leader in the community. Fair. Nobody is 100% truly evil. And as you talk to people, you can find a spot in there. Like Zernona Clayton was helpful in pointing out some positive aspects of Calvin Craig.
What are some of the other obituaries that meant the most to you in your career?
All of them. Don't you hate that answer? Don't you hate it? I approached obits, or all my writing really is, I have to get my lead done first. And that sort of sets the tone for the whole rest of the story. And then I usually like to tie it up with a little bow at the end. I'm not all that good at that part of it, but I do work very hard on the lead. And there was something I liked and enjoyed about every single obit I wrote. And I do have a couple of my leads here that I like. And
you can kind of
see if you... One that I like, a short lead to me is always a better lead. And the lead on George Hopkins obit said, George Hopkins died again Friday. That was the entire lead. In World War II, he tested diving equipment. You know, the old big heavy canvas suits with the huge metal hood. And drowned and died while testing one. And they got him to the surface and they resuscitated him. And he went on to become a lawyer here in Atlanta. He died at 83. His children went to a private school here, and one of the girls came home complaining one day about some homework, and they complained in class, and the teacher said, you don't have a license to complain. And so Mr. Hopkins that night drew up a legal license to complain for every child in that class. And said, so that's an example of you find another dimension in a person's life. Now, I think a good obit gives you a sense of time and place and maybe connects you to the past. And Thelma Hogan at Tucker was the hostess at Matthew's restaurant there. And this was the lead on her obit. Now, I'll tell you about the picture I got to go with it afterwards. At Matthew's cafeteria, a smiling Thelma Hogan called you by your first name, asked after your mama, made sure your cornbread was cooked just like you'd like it, and hugged your child in her lap while she rang up your lunch on the cash register. She did that about 800 times a day for 43 years. I had written this story. It had moved to the line editor, was out of my hands, when I got the photo from the restaurant to run with the obit. And it was a marvelous color photo of Thelma Hogan sitting at the cash register with somebody's baby in her hands, in her arms. And I said, that obit's goddess has helped us again. Another favorite I had was, I have to be honest with you, this obit almost wrote itself because this man's daughter-in-law was so wonderful to talk to. It was just me taking notes down and quotes down as fast as I could. And it's for Claude Miller, who was 104 when he died. He lived in Ackworth. Claude Miller started his day with some fried streakaline or fatback and a homemade buttered biscuit with brown sugar on it. Then he set out for a day working at a sawmill, making moonshine and bootlegging on the side. Mr. Miller's schoolhouse was a sawmill. His education was how to take a one-hand bucksaw, fell a tree, and cut off every single limb till it was smooth as butter.
That's pretty
He made apple brandy that I wish the family had had a little stash of. But she said even not long before he died, he still wanted to go up to the manse and get some apples and make him some brandy.
You wrote an obituary of your own mom, and it too has some lines in it that have been held up by a lot of people who write obituaries as examples of what you did over the years so well, which was to find little details that told the story.
I don't like writing obits about people I know and family members, but I am called upon to do it, so I do. I think I'm too close to them. I think I'll never be able to do them justice. There's always something that has to be. But anyway, my sisters insisted, and I don't know exactly how it goes, but it was something like there were 13 toothbrushes in her bathroom, all kept there by people who visited her regularly.
Yeah, I will. In fact, I pulled it. The line says, in fact, after she was widowed, there were 13 toothbrushes in her bathroom, all kept there by people who regularly enjoyed her company.
And that's true. That's true. I couldn't believe it. I took a look one day and I counted them and I said, Mama. And that just kind of stuck with me when it came time to write the obit. And you're right. It amazes me the people that home in on that.
You also said, though a frugal woman, Mrs. Powell was generous with her hospitality and private acts of charity, compassion, and friendship. She held to traditional values, but was progressive socially and politically. She accepted with grace whatever circumstances befell her and adapted to life changes. That's a very eloquent tribute to your mother.
Thank you. I consider the family written obit an American folk art. In my obits as a journalist, I tell you somebody died. Families have free reign to discuss death any way they want to. My particular favorite comes from an obit in 1996, family written obit in the Valdosta Daily Times, and this is it. It's my all-time favorite. On Wednesday, November 13th, 1996, God saw fit for Brother Morris Sloan Sr. to tell him all about it.
Is there anything unnerving, unsettling, at times depressing about making an occupation out of writing every day or editing every day stories about people who have just died?
No. In fact, it amazed a lot of people, especially newcomers to the newsroom, how much laughter came from the obit section. It was our job.
Did it make you more aware of the fragility of life, do you think?
I've never been kind of a fatalist, but it did make me think you're going to die when you're going to die. Perfectly healthy people would come in from jogging and drop dead, or drop dead on the tennis court, or a young married man on his honeymoon would find a little spot and it'd turn into melanoma, and he was a weightlifter and a bodybuilder and healthy. And then I interviewed about people who lived to 114 or 104, and they had good lives up till almost the end when they just kind of hit a wall. And you're just going to die when you're going to die.
Do you think about your obituary?
I don't think about my obituary as much as I think about dying. I read a piece the other day that shows that people who think about dying and death, or go to funeral homes or cemeteries or whatever, actually are happier people. And I have reached the point, since I am older than you, I've got my will done. I've got my list of things that are to be given to people that aren't necessarily covered by the will. And so I've had a happy life. I've had a good life. I'm not ready to go, but if I do, that's all right. There's another adventure ahead of me.
You look wonderful. You clearly are energetic and still thinking. You're smart. So you probably have a long way to go. But do you give no thought to what is that obituary going to be? Who's going to write it? Are they going to be able to capture me accurately and honestly, and also maybe pick out things that will help people understand me as an individual?
First of all, I told the writer, Candace Dyer, she's in charge of writing my obit.
Why Candace Dyer?
I think she's a great writer, and she looks kind of sideways and underneath at people and finds things that aren't. She is a writer. A lot of her work shows up in Atlanta Magazine. She lives up in the mountains. She's been around for a long time. She's a very good writer. She does a lot of writing about musicians and the music scene. So I told Candace, you're in charge of writing my obit. That being said, I have two sisters that probably will go with a dot-da-dot-da-dot-da-dot resume obit for me. I have no idea.
Kay Powell wrote obituaries for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution from 1996 to 2009. Our August 2014 interview was one of my favorite two-way streets. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll share our conversation with another illustrious Southern voice, best-selling author Frances Mays. Street is about to mark 3 years on the air. And as we head toward our anniversary, we're going to be playing some of our favorite shows throughout June. Today we're highlighting shows that feature our favorite Southern voices. In the summer of 2014, we talked with Georgia native Frances Mays. She'd become famous thanks to her book, Under the Tuscan Sun. We talked to her just after her book, Under Magnolia, was published. It's an account of growing up in Fitzgerald, Georgia. I was surprised that Frances found many similarities between living in Tuscany and living in Fitzgerald.
If you've spent a lot of time in Tuscany, I think you begin to realize how much the life in Tuscany resembles the life that I knew growing up in Georgia, that intense sense of community in a small town, the warmth and generosity of the people, the way everything centers on food, and you're talking about food in the morning before you can even decide what you're going to have. You're going to be planning the next meal. And I think there are many similarities, not only the heat, but selling watermelons on the side of the road, intense sense of family. There are just so many crossovers that I found living in Tuscany.
In fact, if you don't mind my reading a sentence or two from your book, you say this: one reason I felt immediately at home in Tuscany was the certain strong currents of life reminding me of the South. The warmth of people and their astonishing generosity felt so familiar, and I knew well that identical y'all come hospitality.
Everything's culturally centered around the table. And I recently moved back to the South, and I'm just delighted to arrive here for this food revolution that's in progress, because it just kind of intensifies everything I ever felt about Southern food. It's local, that you celebrate the seasons as they come along, and just so much creativity around food.
When the New York Times reviewed Under the Tuscan Sun, at least one of the reviews in the Times was written by a woman who described you in terms that another author had used for someone else. She called you a domestic sensualist. Did you relate to that and understand what that meant?
I do. I have an obsession around houses. I always have. And I've been primarily a writer, but I've always been interested in what can be renovated next and what can be planted in the garden next. So I do have those obsessions. When I go to a new town, I want to ride around in the residential area, see how people live in that place, because I think where you are is so much who you are. That's a belief that was certainly formed by living in the South.
But what about the sensualist part of that? What do you take that to mean about you?
That's true, too. I've always been fascinated by the images that make something real, particularly in writing. If you can awaken two or three senses in a sentence, the reader has no choice but to respond because it connects with them immediately. So that kind of the senses inform my writing. And also the way I live, I like to really observe where I am and look at the quality of light and the tastes and the smells. And I think that definitely comes from growing up in the fecund, humid, blissful South. That just is part of it. You get such a sense of the land because it's close to you. There are tornadoes, there are limestone sinkholes, there are serpents, there are trees that breathe through their knees. It's just such an alive world. And I've always responded to that.
In fact, you talk about serpents. You write at one point in your book about a 12-foot-long black snake that took up residence on your front porch.
Yes.
Growing up when you were in
Fitzgerald. Yes, it was the biggest snake I've ever seen, and he eventually curled himself around the doorknob.
So let's talk about your journey. You grew up in Fitzgerald. We'll talk in a moment about some of the unhappy aspects of growing up there. But you decided at a certain point to move west. You felt you had to go west. And you say at one point, if I ever get out of here, I will never select unhappiness. When the plate of unhappiness is passed around and more is offered, I'll say no, thank you, no. But they wanted seconds, thirds. What are you talking about?
My parents were chaotic. My father ran the cotton mill in the South Georgia town, Fitzgerald. My mother did all the Southern lady things. But beyond that, they were they're kind of a chaotic family. And a couple of the reviewers have mentioned my dysfunctional family, but really they were just Southern. So my mother was pushing me from a very early age not to do what she did, but to live a big life, to experience the world. And she was very influential on me. My family now says I took the first thing smoking on the runway, and I look at them and say, there wasn't a runway. But anyway, I left, and my grandfather said, everything that's loose rolls west. God tilted the universe at the Rockies. And that sounded awfully good to me when I was 22 years old.
And you ended in San Francisco.
San Francisco. I taught creative writing there for 25 years. And then had this major epiphany when I was visiting Oxford, Mississippi on a book tour. Connected with the place so profoundly on this rainy weekend that by the end of the weekend, I had decided that I wanted to move back to the South.
You're writing about, and it's early in the book, about rediscovering the South in Oxford, Mississippi, is absolutely thrilling.
Thank you.
You say at one point, and I don't know that this, frankly, relates specifically to Oxford, but it makes the point. To those whose ribs were formed from red clay, the places complex, exhilarating, charged, various, mighty brown rivers to float along, horizons drawn with an indigo pen, impossibly tall longleaf pines, virulent racism then and not all erased now, the heat that makes your heart beat thickly against your chest. That's a wonderful description
Thank
of life
you.
In the South.
Thank you. I write in the book a whole lot about place. I've always read all the Southern writers, and of course, you're just imbued with sense of place if you grow up as a kind of literary child. And I think that one of the reasons I wrote the book was kind of a homage to the place itself. One of my favorite parts in writing was a description I did of my first visit to the Okefenokee Swamp. A lot of things about land really imprinted on me early. The Golden Isles of Georgia I loved as a child. There's a chapter on that. So I've always loved the kind of metabolic connection of the body and the place and have always felt extremely connected here.
It feels to me, as I read this new book, that a lot of the imagery is tied up with, and a lot of the feelings you have, are tied up with the heat of the South, the hot summers, despite the air conditioning. It really imbues the whole experience of living in the South, doesn't it?
It does. I love the humidity. People are always saying to me when I go back to San Francisco, you stand it, it's so hot down there. I love it. I love the humidity. And, you know, you take a shower and get dressed and you walk out and 10 minutes later you're just limp. It's wonderful.
You come back here with some regularity because you still have friends. You're in Atlanta with some regularity, correct?
Yes, I have family here. I don't get down to Fitzgerald as much as I used to because my mother died 14 years ago.
Yeah.
But I come to the South all the time.
How hard was it to write about your parents, some of their foibles, eccentricities, knowing that you would be back with family and friends here and you would have to you would have exposed your past in this way?
Your family, yes. I think anyone who attempts memoir does it by treading on a lot of ethical issues and shaky ground. I felt growing up in the South was larger than life in some ways, and I felt like it was a story I really had to had to write.
Yeah.
So I wrote it, and I found in the process of writing memoir that it helps you so much to make a story of your life really makes it a lot more sensible to you than it does if you don't try that.
And now you live in a house built in
1806
in
Hillsborough, North Carolina, which is a wonderful small community full of writers, artists, just all kinds of creative people, and we absolutely love it.
Under Magnolia, a Southern memoir. It's a magical book. And as usual, your writing is exquisite.
Thank you so much,
Thank you for
Bill.
Spending time with us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
We talked with Frances Mays in the summer of 2014. I have one more favorite Southern voice to share with you today. Late last year, the great humorist Roy Blunt Jr. came into our studios to talk about his book, Save Room for Pi. Roy grew up in Decatur, and of course he went on to become one of the most famous interpreters of Southern life for people across the country. As we started, I asked Roy to read us a passage from Make Room for Pies about his childhood.
As a boy in Decatur, Georgia, I would ride my bike to the gas station, in front of which stood a big, rusting, red metal box with a slide-open door at the top. I'd reach down into that well of ice, gradually melting among variously shaped cold bottles randomly heaped. And I'd swish around heavily for a while and come up with a new grape, a grapeette, a sum drop, an orange crush with its pebbly, thick-walled bottle the color of iodine, a Byerly's chocolate drink. Byerly's put out an orange, too. A knee-high black cherry, an RC Cola, a Dr. Pepper, a frosty root beer, a squirt, a Canada Dry ginger ale. Ice water would run down my arm, and I would have myself a very cold, highly satisfactory drink. I don't think anything has ever struck me as prettier colored than new grape foam back then. I was a child with little experience of the world. But in college English, when I came upon, quote, the blushful hippocrene with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple stained mouth, it brought back new grape.
That sounds like an absolutely wonderful memory, that the sort of memory that stays with you.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, I don't know how classy it is, but it's fond.
Why save room for pie?
Well, pie being the highest form of food. When we say sweet as an angel eating pie, we do not mean icky, we mean sublime. Eudora Welty, in her story Kin, celebrates the perfect ending to a pleasant day. Quote, wonderful black, bitter, moist chocolate pie under mountains of meringue. Ralph Waldo Emerson, according to his friend James B. Thayer, loved pie so much he ate it regularly for breakfast. One morning, Emerson offered several gentlemen guests, one after another, a piece of pie. Each gentleman declined, but Mr. Emerson remonstrated, thrusting the knife under a piece of the pie and putting the entire weight of his character into his manner. But what is pie for?
those are just great stories. That's Roy Blunt Jr. reading from his new book, Save Room for Pie. You will not eat foam.
No.
No, none of this molecular gastronomy.
Exactly. What's the point of that? I mean, reducing food down to its elements is what I'm supposed to do in my digestion, not the chef. Bacon foam and mushroom foam. I mean, who wants that? So I much prefer things that like gizzards, which about which you can say the harder something is to eat, the longer you get to taste it. I grew up eating Varsity hot dogs, and they have a kind of chili there. The Varsity chili is different from any other chili I've ever had, and it fits just beautifully on a hot dog. Buns. I knew a man who drove a bread truck and delivered buns to the Varsity years ago, and he said that they would not accept any bun that you couldn't wrap around your finger without it cracking. And so the buns are nice and soft, and they give you a big old handful of onions to put on your chili dog, and they put just a little stripe of mustard on there. You know, lots of chili dogs are just sort of sloppy all over, but one thing, Varsity chili is very finely ground, doesn't have beans in it or anything, and so it all holds together. It doesn't slop off into your hands.
You tell a story in the book about coming to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me at the Fox Theater, and of course you were right around the corner from the Varsity.
Yeah, I'm nostalgic about Varsity hot dogs and also about the Fox Theater. I used to go to the Fox Theater when I was a kid. One time I dropped my chewing gum on the floor while I was watching a movie in the Fox Theater, and I reached down and picked it up and started chewing it again, and my mother was horrified, but then she said, oh, well, I guess it's okay. It is the fox.
It is the fox. Gruesome. You have a number of songs in the book. My personal favorite happens to be Song to Oysters.
Ah, yeah.
But is it an actual song, or is it just the lyric to a song?
It's not, there's no tune to it.
Okay.
Every now and then people offer to write music to my some of my food songs, and I'll let them do it, and they tend to be kind of high-flown choral versions of them. But I can recite for you my song to oysters. I don't think really needs music. I like to eat an uncooked oyster. Nothing's slicker, nothing's moister. Nothing's easier on your gorge or when the time comes to discharge. But not to let it too long rest within your mouth is always best. For if your mind dwells on an oyster, nothing's slicker, nothing's moister. I prefer my oyster fried. Then I'm sure my oysters die.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
So in finishing up, I wanted to try a few pies with you.
Have you got some?
I do.
Well, sure.
Okay. I do. So the Silver Skillet is one of the great Southern diners.
All right.
So I brought you three pies, Roy. There's a coconut cream. You like the way that looks? Here's a chocolate cream, because I think I read in the book you like chocolate cream.
Yeah, your daughter Welty wrote about chocolate cream pie.
But then I brought, so the Silver Skillet's famous for their lemon icebox pie.
All right.
So I brought you some pie, and I brought you some, I brought you a fork.
Well, if I'd known this was coming, I would have saved more room for pie. But, but I will certainly.
So you're going for the coconut cream.
I'm not going to pass it up a nice piece of pie.
Right.
Mm. Great thing, of course, about coconut pie is it's all gooey, but it has those, fiber in it.
A chewy coconut on top. I don't think it can get much better than that.
And then somebody said recently to me, you're either a cake person or a pie person in the same way that you're either a robot person or a monkey person. A pie person goes with the monkey person. Yeah. But I think that's kind of unfair both to the pie and the cake. But pie just has more going on than a cake.
It's good.
I'm going to leave some of this for you. But
believe me, there are people here on our team that would love that. I think you're going now for the lemon
refrigerator for the lemon now.
Pie. So as we close.
That's good because it's got that tang, of course, the lemon tang that cuts into the sweetness. But the sweetness is there.
There's there. So when you started writing about the South, and in some ways explaining the South in your own humorous style to people from other parts of the country, does the country still see the South in the way that it did when Jimmy Carter was in the White House? Has the country come to see the South differently, or is the South so much different than
I think the South has spread. I mean, you can get good Southern food in Brooklyn now. You can get, I remember when you couldn't get, they didn't really understand fried chicken in the North, but you can get good Southern food, and it's even kind of fashionable now in New York. So there's that. And but still, people tell, you know the term microaggression? I get a lot of microaggressions as a Southerner. In the North, people don't even realize there's anything. You know, they get this kind of expression on their face and talk about the South as this bizarre kind of place. And Southern food, even, they'll say, you know, look at me like, I know you don't really like it, but just tell us, you know, do your thing, do your little act about Southern food. In fact, I love Southern food, and I don't know why everybody else doesn't. If they don't, I don't care. Let them morph Southern food for me if they think it's silly. But, I mean, there's still people still feel entitled to be at least microaggressive about the South. And, you know, one reason is that Southerners don't tend to call them on it that much. Southerners tend to roll with it, and if they get really offensive, then Southerners will hit them.
We talked with Roy Blunt Jr. when his book, Make Room for Pie, was released late last year. Before we leave you today, I want to remind you of the news we first announced on this show last week. Starting on July 6th, Two-Way Street is moving to 2 p.m. on Thursday afternoons. We're excited about joining the weekday lineup of great NPR shows on GPB Radio. We'll continue to rebroadcast the show on Sunday mornings at 11. Our senior producer is the learnedly loquacious Jenny Ament. Our producer is the long-standingly logical Lisa Clark. Our associate producer, the likably level-headed Olivia Rheingold. And our engineer is the laudably lion-hearted Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.